From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this Christmas Eve edition of Fresh Air, a review of the year in movies and music, our film critic David Edelstein will talk with us about his 10 best list, and our rock critic Ken Tucker will consider some of the ups and downs in rock, hip-hop, pop, and country and run down his 10 best list. The year in movies and music coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The French government has ordered Air France to cancel Christmastime flights to and from Los Angeles. The American embassy in Paris expressed fears of a terror attack. NPR's Nick Spicer reports from the French capital.
A total of 6 flights between Paris and Los Angeles have been canceled on December 24th and Christmas Day. The French Prime Minister's office said in a statement that the order to cancel followed from information that the safety of the flights was at stake. France's Interior Ministry said the U.S. Embassy in Paris requested the cancellations. Some of the French media report that the government had no choice and that the U.S. government would have denied flyover rights. However, there are conflicting reports about the American request, about whether U.S. officials thought an Al-Qaeda operative might be aboard a flight, or whether the fear was less specific. Meanwhile, British government officials have said there is no change in travel advice for passengers flying from the United Kingdom to France. Nick Spicer, NPR News, Paris.
Cattle and grain prices fell sharply today following reports of the first case of mad cow disease ever in the U.S. NPR's David Shaper reports from Chicago.
With noisy trading pits for other commodities all around them, traders in the cattle futures pit of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange had little to do. Trading pretty much stopped before it began, as cattle prices fell immediately on the opening bell, the maximum allowed, $1.50 per hundredweight. Grain prices on the Chicago Board of Trade fell sharply too, especially the price of corn, as cattle are the largest consumers of corn. Analyst Joe Victor of the research firm Allendale Incorporated says such losses may continue.
We'll probably have a couple of 2 to 3 days of shakedown in the cattle, and depending on how far that the cattle futures do want to explore and discover that price, could see a little bit more of a negative pull on the corn.
Victor says the full impact of this one case of mad cow disease on the grain and cattle markets isn't yet known and may depend on whether or not consumers buy beef. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
Military officials in Iraq say 3 American soldiers were killed today in a bombing near the town of Samarra, north of Baghdad. Earlier today, a suicide bomber struck in the northern Kurdish city of Erbil. The BBC's Christopher Hogg has more from Baghdad.
The roadside bomb was detonated as a U.S. military convoy passed by on a road near the town of Samarra, destroying a military vehicle. These improvised explosive devices have proved a simple yet effective weapon against coalition forces. The suicide bomber in the town of Erbil in northern Iraq killed the guards outside the Interior Ministry offices there and a passerby. Among those wounded were people inside the building, which caught fire after the blast.
The BBC's Christopher Hogg in Baghdad. Stock prices showed little change today in pre-holiday trading on Wall Street. The Dow was down 36 to 10,305. The Nasdaq was down 5 to 1969. This is NPR News. The New York Port Authority says the Delta Airlines terminal at New York's LaGuardia Airport was evacuated today. A spokeswoman for the Transportation Security Administration said a woman passenger set off a metal detector and kept on going into the terminal. All departing Delta flights were grounded for security reasons, while security personnel searched for the woman. Spanish authorities say they've thwarted a Christmas Eve massacre at a train terminal in Madrid. The announcement came after police arrested suspected members of the Basque separatist group ETA, allegedly involved in a bombing plot. Jerome Sokolovsky reports from Madrid.
Authorities say the explosion was timed to coincide with the rush of passengers through the Madrid train station just ahead of Christmas Eve. But police got wind of the plot after they arrested an ETA suspect in possession of explosives in the northern Basque city of San Sebastian. The police then found out that a second suspect had already planted a 55-pound bomb on a train that was heading from San Sebastian to Madrid. The train was stopped and the other suspect was taken into custody. The attempted attack comes after a key ETA leader was arrested in France earlier this month. The outlawed separatist group has been fighting since the 1960s for an independent Basque homeland in northern Spain. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolovsky in Madrid.
A three-judge panel in Washington says the Environmental Protection Agency may not make changes to Clean Air Act regulations until legal challenges from states and cities have been resolved. The new regulations would have allowed power plants, refineries, and other industrial facilities to upgrade their plants without installing additional pollution controls. The S&P 500 lost 2 points today to close at 1,094. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The holiday season is also the season of the 10 Best list, so this time of year we like to invite our rock and film critics to talk with us about their impressions of the year. First, we'll talk with Fresh Air's film critic, David Edelstein. He's also the film critic for the online magazine Slate. David Edelstein, welcome. We asked you to bring your 10 Best list, and you haven't been totally compliant because what you've brought isn't exactly 10.
No, I go to 11 every year. This is, I admire people who can put them all into neat little 10-movie boxes, but I normally go to 11, and now I've decided to make 11 the rule, and also that way, if I have one there that a few years later is just completely outlandish, I can just go, well, what do you want? It was the 11th movie, you know? I mean, it was sort of like last year, Gangs of New York, you know? It was 11. It doesn't count.
Would you read your 10 best list for us?
With pleasure. My number one movie of the year is a documentary called Spellbound. That's followed by The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, then Jim Sheridan's In America, then the animated feature The Triplets of Belleville, then Lost in Translation, followed by Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, then Finding Nemo, then The Company, directed by Robert Altman, The Sun, followed by The Dancer Upstairs, and School of Rock.
Thank you. Okay, well, Spellbound, a documentary, is at the top of the list. That's kind of interesting because, you know, not only because it's a documentary topping your list, but it's one of several really good documentaries that came out this year. Name some of the others that were among your favorites.
Well, this has been a great year for documentaries. Capturing the Freedmen certainly could have been on this list. So could a Brazilian documentary called Bus 174. So could a movie called Winged Migrations, which chronicles the flight of birds, which has no narrative whatsoever, and yet I think brings you closer to the real world than just about anything else on screen. I think this is the kind of year in which many of us were a little bit tired of certain kinds of mainstream Hollywood formulas, and we were just looking for a little more ambiguity, a little more open-ended stories, a little movies in which we could bring our own minds and help complete them in our heads, movies in which we could allow our minds to play with the ingredients in a way that many artists in mainstream movies, well, they really don't let you do it because they have a lot of studio development people sitting on them and saying, no, the audience isn't going to understand that. No, we can't leave them with that ambiguity. No, we have to pin this down. Documentary directors really aren't bound by the same formulas that fictional filmmakers are.
I'll add two other documentaries to your list of films that were really interesting this year, My Architect and The Fog of War, about former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. Now, you have two animated films on your 10 best list, The Triplets of Belleville and Finding Nemo. Are they there for their technical achievements or just for their larger qualities as good movies?
No, I would never put something there just for technical reasons. If it doesn't connect with your heart and your mind, then it has no place on any list. The Triplets of Belleville is something that doesn't even make a lot of sense. It's about a grandma whose boy is kidnapped from the Tour de France by French wine-drinking gangsters and taken to a distant metropolis across the ocean, and it's about how she and her train-loving dog fall in with these three ancient frog-slurping sisters who used to be nightclub chanteuses and still are in a way. And there's no, I don't really understand what the movie is about, but I was reading a very interesting memoir the other day about the making of the Sondheim musical Follies by Ted Chapin, and there's just this little throwaway passage about the great caricaturist Al Hirschfeld, who drew the opening week Alexa Smith crossing the stage and doing this little twist with her waist. And the author says that he'd seen her make that cross about 100 times, and he'd never registered that thing she was doing, and it illuminated her entire personality. He'd never seen it until he saw it through the eyes of Al Hirschfeld. And that's what I felt when I saw Triplets of Belleville. I felt like I'd never seen the human form until I'd seen it through the eyes of Sylvain Chomet, who's the director. I'd never seen the sort of deco, the sort of surreal deco hallucination of a 20s nightclub in the same way. I'd never seen a bicycle in the same way. I'd never seen a calf muscle in the same way. I mean, this is a movie that kind of brings you as close to the inner reality, even closer, as any surreal masterpiece by David Lynch.
Now, Lost in Translation is on your list. I know that although it's on your top 10 list, you're a little conflicted about the movie. What's your conflict?
Yeah, I'm very conflicted about it. On one hand, it's a mood piece that I think is really transfixing. It's kind of a poem of alienation and then connection between an older man and a younger woman. On the other hand, there's something narcissistic and entitled about Sofia Coppola's two protagonists that isn't a great advertisement for Americans abroad. It's almost as if the sense of otherness and of cultural superiority merges a little uncomfortably for my taste. On the other hand, it's the great Bill Murray performance. It's the one we've been waiting for. It seems to me that it merged the two halves of Bill Murray in a way that we've never seen before. It connects his kind of his detachment, which is what's so hilarious about him, and the kind of sense of isolation that must have spawned that detachment, which, you know, I thought of it as Saturday Night Live meets Chekhov.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Now, Lord of the Rings is on your 10 best list. I'll be honest with you, I can't bring myself to see any of the Lord of the Rings movies. I'm one of those people who, like in college, I figured, okay, I'll read The Hobbit, and after about 100 pages, I thought, okay, I won't read The Hobbit. I couldn't keep interested in it, so I figured, why would I go see the movie?
Well, Terry, you did better than me.
You couldn't even get
that
far.
With Tolkien. Uh-huh. I, you know, it's funny. I have friends who I respect a great deal who have read this thing in all its parts 4, 5, 6 times. I'm not kidding. And I've always wanted to, and I've tried, but there's something about I just have to read the words Bilbo Baggins of Bag Ends, and my eyelids get very heavy, you know. it's just, you know, I drop over the book, and you know, this is great movie making, and I think that you don't have to be a Tolkien file in order to understand the greatness of Peter Jackson's filmmaking. This is a man who simply makes war pictures on a scale that modern filmmakers have forgotten. It reminds you of Eisenstein or Kurosawa or Orson Welles in his great Falstaff film called Chimes at War. Nobody mixes up perspectives the way he does, so that you start with something very tiny like a worm or a rock, and then you move to hundreds of thousands of demonic orcs crashing across the battlefield with giant trolls and big winged dragons and 7-story elephants, and then you're back to somebody's eyes, and then you're back to something really small, and then something huge, and it's the weave that is so exciting and transporting about this filmmaking. Also, you know, he may have 8 different special effects things going on, elaborate things going on in a shot, and yet his camera retains a kind of handheld documentary feel. You really think that he's just sort of happened on this incredible activity rather than that he's staged it and he's caught it the way a documentary filmmaker would. It's great and exciting filmmaking. I should tell you, I know this because one of the highlights of my movie-going year was going to the Lord of the Rings marathon. Do you know about the Lord of the Rings marathon?
No, I guess I was hiding from that one.
People lined up for days to get tickets to sit in a theater and watch not just the regular cuts, but the extended cuts of all 3 movies, of the first 2 movies, followed by the 3rd movie. And it ended up being about 14 and a half hours in the theater. And I just want to tell you, I loved every second of it. It was, I mean, movie audiences are so non-committal. But to get them to hang out somewhere for 14 hours and just kind of groove on each other's presence, on each other's enthusiasm and passion, I learned so much from watching these movies in the company of these people who had sacrificed so much of their time and their money, and they had lied their way out of jobs and played hooky from school just to be in this audience and to drink it in. And then in the middle of it, you know, the four of the hobbits came, three of the hobbits and one golem came, and the audience just raised the roof and went crazy. And then they left, and then the third movie began, and I've just never seen an audience in heaven like that. So that was a really exciting thing, and it can only happen in the movies. It can't happen online, and it can't happen with your TV set. I guess it could happen with Wagner's Ring Cycle, but this is, I guess, the Wagner's Ring Cycle for the modern audience.
My guest is Fresh Air film critic David Edelstein. We'll talk more about the year in movies after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Edelstein, Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for Slate, and we're talking about the year in movies. Well, a movie that is absent from your 10 best list I wanted to ask you about is American Splendor. I thought that was one of the best of the year, the movie based on the life and comics of Harvey Pekar.
I loved it, too. I think, you know, that's a movie that ended a little quickly for my taste. Didn't you think that all of a sudden it was over? He had his little bout with cancer, and he turned it into a comic book, and all of a sudden the movie ended. For a while there, it was this wonderful weave of Pekar's comics and the actors making the movie about Pekar and Pekar himself, and it had this amazing performance by Hope Davis as sort of the nerd goddess of all time. And yet somehow, I don't know that the movie ever managed, for me anyway, to kind of transcend the raw material in a way that maybe some of Pekar's comic books do at their best. There wasn't that sort of fleeting sense of melancholy and hopelessness that I get when I'm really immersed in a good Pekar comic book.
I thought the ending was very good because, just as you're expecting a kind of nice, tidy, probably happy ending, it kind of undercuts that because things aren't that tidy. Things are still really messy in his life. So
that's true. That's true.
Not that I'm hoping that things stay messy in his life, but I thought it didn't deliver a kind of cheap ending in that respect. School of Rock,
right,
is on your 10 best list. That was just a really fun, satisfying movie. It takes a lot of predictable elements and makes it into something pretty fresh.
School of Rock is a movie that I literally went out and I grabbed the publicist from Paramount and I said, "Do you realize this is the best movie ever made?" Now, in the light of day, even in the light of evening, I thought that was maybe an extravagant claim. But, you know, remember when you used to go to a rock concert and you would just be so, so picked up. There would be something so transcendent about what you were watching. There was such a sense of connection. And in this case, you were connected to Richard Linklater and Mike White's sort of love of this dinosaur hard rock genre and Jack Black's kind of touching nostalgia, mm-hmm, for an era in which he could be a rock god. And the joke was, of course, he couldn't be a rock god. He could only be a rock god for 10-year-olds. But that was enough. That was beautiful enough. And hey, if you could send your 10-year-olds out into the world with that kind of sense of themselves and what was possible, then that's a pretty good movie.
Well, we've heard your 10 best list. What were some of your biggest disappointments of the year, or the films that most irritated you that you expected more from?
Well, the Cat in the Hat is by far and away the most repulsive thing I've seen all year. Did you see it?
No. What made it so bad?
Oh, it was grotesque. Dr. Seuss's sensibility was very anarchic and very crazy, but it was contained within this sort of beautiful anapestic tetrameter and these designs of of just wonderful, these wonderful creatures, these serene creatures who were so happy amid this chaos. This movie was just a sort of loud, crude vaudeville act in which was full of poop jokes and belch jokes and Mike Myers doing an imitation of Bert Lahr's Cowardly Lion, which was completely mystifying. It just seemed to have nothing to do with the original material.
David, let's talk a little bit about films that are opening for the holidays, because I'm sure our listeners will be wanting to see some of those movies.
Well, I certainly would encourage people to see my best film of the year, Spellbound. For those who don't know, it documents the sort of 1999 Nerd Olympics, the nationwide spelling bee contestants assembling in Washington. This is a movie that is as its competition, its history, its sociology, its deeply humanistic portraits, its meditations on the language, its killer suspense, its intense heartbreak. I just don't think there's anything in fictional film that can compare to it. And it's available now for rental. I also would encourage people to see The Company, which is Robert Altman's semi-fictional, semi-documentary portrait of the Joffrey Ballet with Neve Campbell stuck in the middle of it. This is a movie that does not have much of a narrative. In fact, I found the narrative a little frustrating in spots, especially at the ending. But what I love best about it is, you know, here's this filmmaker, Robert Altman, who has what seems to be the loosest frame in movies. Everything's off-center and in flux and babbling and indirect, and you're always working to pick out the narrative threads. And yet, here he is shooting ballet in which every muscle of these people is choreographed. And his framing, it feels just as uninsistent, and yet nobody in the last few decades has captured dance with this kind of alertness and sort of rhapsodic alertness. It's an absolutely exhilarating movie, but don't expect to come out knowing exactly what happened in the storyline, because that's not the movie's strong suit. You won't get one of these great ripping soap opera yarns like The Turning Point or The Red Shoes.
So The Company's opening on Christmas Day, but that's a pretty select run, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I think so. If you want to see Christmas Day, we have Cold Mountain is opening, and it's a movie that doesn't really work until about midway through, when the sort of very conventional melodrama kicks in. But I think it's beautifully done, and it's harrowing, and it's a terrific ensemble, even though some of them are Miramax actors kind of doing a guest hillbilly thing. But I think a movie with that kind of complex a view of war is important for people to see right now.
Would you recommend Something's Gotta Give, the new comedy with Jack Nicholson and Diane Keaton?
I would recommend Something's Gotta Give very guardedly if you want to see these two old pros playing with each other, having fun, transcending age, transcending the formula conventions of a certain kind of mainstream film screwball comedy. I think there's just a great deal of pleasure in seeing Diane Keaton in this film playing a woman who is much less dithery and neurasthenic than we recall from her Annie Hall days, playing a woman who actually is very tart, very defended, very funny and strident, but also has, of course, a hysterical side, this being Diane Keaton. I think it's a beautiful love letter to Diane Keaton, this movie, and Jack Nicholson abets her superbly.
David, would you say this has been a good or a bad year for film overall?
I think this has been a wonderful year for film, and I say that not really knowing what the hell was going to be on my 10 best list this year, because I really could have picked 20 or 25 films that I wanted to recommend to people. I don't know that I feel as strongly about any film this year as I did about The Pianist last year, or some of the films in the last few years, like In the Bedroom or the Robert Duvall film, The Apostle. But I think it's a very healthy film culture right now outside the major studios. In the major studios, I'm worried. One of the most disturbing things for me this year was that a lot of people inside the studios thought of Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, as an art film. They thought it was a film that might not have quite the box office potential because it was such a serious grown-up movie. Now, look, Master and Commander is a popcorn movie if ever I saw one. It's a really smart popcorn movie. But, you know, there's nothing different in Master and Commander. There's nothing you can't find in Star Trek The Next Generation or in some of the old Horatio Hornblower books. You know, it's exactly what a good mainstream Saturday matinee kind of entertainment should be. And the fact that it was perceived in Hollywood as this grown-up art film is a little disturbing to me. It maybe explains why we see so many movies coming out this year based on video games.
Well, David, I hope you have a very good new year.
And, thank you very much, Terry.
I hope we all get to see some good movies in the new year.
Thank you, Terry.
David Edelstein is the film critic for Fresh Air and the online magazine Slate. You can find his 10 best list on our website, freshair.com. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Got a beard that's long and white.
Santa's got a beard that's long and white.
Who comes around on a special night?
Santa comes around on a special night.
Special night, beard that's white. Must be Santa, must be Santa, must be Santa, Santa Claus. Who wears boots and a suit of red?
Santa wears boots and a suit of red.
Who wears a long cap on his head?
Santa wears a long cap on his head.
Cap on head, suit that's red. Special night, beard that's white. Got a big red cherry nose.
Santa's got a big red cherry nose.
Who laughs this way? Ho, ho, ho.
Santa laughs this way. Ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho. Cherry nose. Cap on head. Suit that's red. Special night. Beard that's white. Must be Santa. Must be Santa. Must be Santa. Santa Claus.
Hey, yeah. Look out, Santa. He's coming this way.
Very soon will come our way.
Very soon will come our way.
A little reindeer pull a sleigh.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Myrowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett. Available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Starbucks, offering access to NPR holiday programming through the T-Mobile hotspot service. Available at neighborhood Starbucks during this holiday season. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker talks with us about the year in rock, hip-hop, pop, and country music and runs down his 10 best list. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're spending this Christmas Eve edition reviewing the year in movies and music. With me is Fresh Air's rock critic, Ken Tucker. He's also a critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. After we talk about the year in music, he'll run down his 10 best list. Ken, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Same to you. Thanks.
Thank you. Let's start with something fun.
Outkast put out a big double album. The huge hit single from this is a song called Hey Ya. It's a tremendously fun, catchy, just irresistible song.
And why is this on your list?
It's on my list because I think it's a kind of bridge between cutting-edge hip-hop and old-fashioned rock aesthetics. The idea of releasing a double album, these two guys head up Outkast, Andre Benjamin and Antoine Patton, they just have tremendous ambition, and they made the video of Hey Ya. I don't know if you've seen it, but it reproduces an old Ed Sullivan-style TV show where Andre is singing and playing every single part, and girls are screaming in the audience. And it's a kind of visual metaphor that evokes Beatlemania, and it signals the desire to the audience, I think, that this is a big mass audience appeal act. They want to be as big as the Beatles. And I just found Outkast's open-hearted, open-throated ambition just wonderfully charming, and this particular song just so thrilling.
Let's hear it. This is Outkast, Hey Ya.
1, 2, 3, My baby don't mess around because she loves me so.
That's Outkast, and my guest is Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker. We're talking about the year in pop music. One of the things I really love about that track is that, well, it's so much fun, and there's so much of hip-hop music that just isn't fun. It's really like serious, and it's about like heavy points and heavy things, and it's just so delightful to hear something that's pure fun.
I think so, yeah. It's just a real example of how joyful the music can be. I think also Hey Ya is an example of a song that typifies something that's happening right now. When my 14-year-old daughter saw the video, she loves this song. She listens to it, and I said, hey, you know, Outkast has this great new double CD. You know, you want to listen to this? And she said, no, I'm just interested in that song. And it brought home to me something, which was that we're living in the age of the hit single again. In a sense, we're back to the 50s in a certain way, and it's due to things like downloading off the internet, the use of the iPod, people downloading songs, putting them on, making their own kind of mixtapes themselves and listening to it. And it really signals a kind of shift, I think, away from this concept that we've had for a couple of decades now of the artist, the album as the primary unit of creativity in rock and roll.
How is that affecting the way music is getting released?
Well, it gets released in different ways for different artists. Certainly when you have somebody like Bruce Springsteen, who still thinks of what he does as he releases The Rising, you know, it's a complete statement. You have to sit down and listen to it from beginning to end to have the proper experience. But in the case of other artists, there are just many people who just want to put out as many punchy hit singles as they can. I also think that the CD was very detrimental in this kind of eroding of the album as a coherent statement, in the sense that with the CD, you could put a lot more music onto a CD. And so for now, the past 10, 15 years, artists have just felt obliged that rather than put their best 12 songs, as they used to do on an album, they now have to put, you know, 15, 16, 17 songs, and it leads to, you know, you end up literally putting a lot of your outtakes, stuff that you would leave on the cutting room floor, onto a CD. And so the CD, the CD was a ripoff from day one. You know, it's like the record companies overcharged. They always overstated the fact of how much it cost to manufacture CDs. Once it became apparent that CD was now, everybody had, they had made their profit. They had plundered the record public. Everybody had to switch over from albums to CDs. They'd made their profits that way. They never lowered the prices of CDs until very, very recently and very, very begrudgingly. So when you combine all that, this is a kind of revolt of the consumer. The consumer says, I want the music my way. I want to hear this song, and I want to hear this song by this other artist right next to it. So I'll make my own mixtape on my iPod, burn a CD myself, that kind of thing.
Have you found that you're listening to music differently?
Definitely. I mean, I like taking a cue from my teenage daughter, tend to download things. Here's a good example of it. A song I'd like to play, in fact. There's an act called the Black Eyed Peas, whose albums I haven't really cared for very much in the past. But they have a song called Where's the Love, which they did with Justin Timberlake as a guest star on it. And I think it's a terrific little song, but it's the song on the album to have, and that's it.
Well, why don't we hear it?
What's wrong with the world, mama? People living like they ain't got no mamas. I think the whole world's addicted to the drama. Only attracted to things that'll bring the trauma. Overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism. But we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA. The Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate. And to discriminate only generates hate. And when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah. Madness is what you demonstrate, and that's exactly how anger works and operates. Man, you gotta have love just to set it straight. Take control of your mind and meditate. Let your soul gravitate to the love, y'all.
It's the Black Eyed Peas with Justin Timberlake. My guest is Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker, and we're talking about the year in music. Well, that was a pretty political rap that we just heard, and it's been a political year in a lot of pop music.
It has been. As you heard in that song, you know, references to the war overseas, what many people perceive as still war at home. Early in the year, I think these pop years come out seem like eons ago, but there was that Dixie Chicks controversy toward the beginning of the year when the Dixie Chicks criticized President Bush's policy in Iraq, which in turn was responded to by a very big country act, Toby Keith, who had a hit song called Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, which was subtitled The Angry American. And Toby Keith's new album is called Shock and Y'all. Never one for subtlety, Mr. Keith. Putting politics aside, I mean, I think that the Dixie Chicks put out a better album because it's better music. Toby Keith, you know, has written a couple of good, you know, fun novelty songs. One of the songs he has on his new album is called Weed with Willie, that's all about the potency of Willie Nelson's marijuana. You know, it's a kind of a fun novelty song.
Speaking of Willie Nelson, he had a CD this year of some of his demo recordings that you gave an excellent review to. Where does that fit in your year-end review?
This is really my favorite record of the year. I think it's, even though it has music on it that's 40 years old, the album's called Crazy, The Demo Sessions. And it's an album that has an extraordinary story to it in the sense that Willie Nelson was in his 20s. He was a Texan. He was married with three children. He moved to Nashville, tried to make it as a songwriter. Everybody said to him, songs are pretty good, but not you singing them because your voice is flat and kind of tuneless. But you listen to these demos, which are recorded often just with Willie and his acoustic guitar or Willie in a very small backup band. And the songs are extraordinarily moving. His voice, his very stark, unadorned voice, is really very striking. And he's writing songs that were, even now, very, very complicated emotionally, much more so than just, you know, my baby left me kinds of songs. The song I'd like to play is called Something to Think About. And when you listen to it, well, listen to the lyric, and we'll talk a bit about it when we come out of it.
Yeah, great.
One thing I would have you do, please consider the dawn. dawn of your lonely years, when youth and beauty are gone, and when you can no longer have any sweetheart you choose. Here's something to think about. I'll still be thinking of you.
Now, just think about what's being said in that song. There's this sentiment that he's always going to be in love with this woman who's dumped him, and that what he's asking her to do is to think about years from now, when your looks have been ravaged by age, I'm still going to love you, I'm still going to be thinking about you. It's a sentiment you just don't hear anywhere in popular music, let alone in the teen pop that so much dominates right now. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful song.
With me is Ken Tucker, Fresh Air's rock critic and critic at large for Entertainment Weekly, and we're talking about the year in music. Why don't we take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more and hear some more music. This is Fresh Air. My guest is our rock critic, Ken Tucker, who is also a critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. And we're talking about the year in pop music. We just heard from a veteran, Willie Nelson. Let's talk about teen pop. And it seems like a lot of the teenagers who became stars are getting older already.
They are.
I wonder what's happening to them and to their audiences as both the original audience and the performer ceases to be kids anymore.
Well, that's the challenge, is to try to bring them along. And I think a lot of teenagers, as they now get older, move into hip-hop, and that's also true of these artists. I mean, I think Justin Timberlake had the kind of surprisingly credible solo debut album. He was a member of NSYNC, and he has put aside a lot of that kind of teen pop melodies and ventured much more forcefully into hip-hop, with surprisingly positive response both from his audience and from other hip-hop artists. And certainly, you know, Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera have tried to do it, but no one as successfully as Justin Timberlake. I think in part because he comes from the South, he comes from Memphis, and he has a real sense of history. He had a TV special around Christmas time, Thanksgiving, poorly rated, but he had Al Green on, and Al Green told me that his mother is neighbors with Justin Timberlake's mother, and so they've known each other for years and years and years, and so it was very natural for Justin to invite Al Green on. He's got a sense of history, and you can hear it when he sings. In particular, a song like that became a hit called "Cry Me a River."
Why don't we hear it? This is Justin Timberlake.
You were my sun. You were my earth. You didn't know all the ways I loved you. No, so you took a chance and made of a plan, but I bet you didn't think that they would come crashing down. No, you don't have to say what you did. I already know. I found out from you. There's just no chance for you and me. There'll never be. And don't it make you sad about it? Told me you love me.
That's Justin Timberlake. My guest is Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker, and we're talking about the year in music. Is it acceptable for you to like Justin Timberlake? Do people mock you when you say you like Justin Timberlake, or does he have
more
cred now?
Oh, boy, do they mock. No. A guy like me is not supposed to, you're a serious rock critic. It's the age-old thing. This rock critics have been suffering from this for liking what's actually popular, what a good segment of the audience likes for years and years and years.
Well, Justin Timberlake represents a kind of very commercial teen pop, a very heartthrob rock. What about the less commercial side of rock? What do you want to say about the era in that part of the music?
Well, it was a tremendously good year for this kind of pop rock that in the past has always been very much a cult thing since the 60s. There's always been bands who want to kind of hark back to those kinds of 2-3 minute, fast, quick, got a vocal hook in it and make their point and scram kind of music. This year you had bands like Fountains of Wayne, The Strokes, The Shins, The Yeah Yeah Yeahs. It's amazing how many good bands came around this year. The New Pornographers, all these bands that I reviewed on the show, The High Strung, and my favorite three that kind of are rhyming trio, The Thrills, The Kills, and The Stills. But the Fountains of Wayne, I think, put out the best record of the year. And the song I'd like to play from that, it's called Welcome Interstate Managers is the name of the album. And the song that I'd like to play from that is called Bright Future in Sales.
Sleeping on a planter at the Port Authority, waiting for my bus to come. Seven scotch and sodas at the office party, now I don't remember where I'm from. I think I had a black wallet in my back pocket with a bus ticket and a picture of my baby inside. And if I make it home alive, I'm gonna get my shit together, 'cause I can't live like this forever. I know I've come too far and I don't wanna fail. I got a new computer and a bright future in sales, yeah, yeah.
That's Fountains of Wayne. My guest is Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker, and we're talking about the year in pop music. Ken, I have to tell you, I heard this in the drugstore. I mean, just as a sign that like they've actually caught on into the commercial market.
Yeah, I mean, Fountains of Wayne is the only one of those groups that I've named that really broke through. I mean, they had a hit single with Stacy's Mom, which, you know, is a very catchy song, which, you know, I just wonder how many kids listening to it really realize what it's about. But, it had a video that got played on MTV, and it really broke through. So jolly good for them.
Do you think that a lot of the young bands, like a lot of like the retro rock bands and a lot of like even the hip-hop groups and stuff have listened to their parents' records, used to listen to their parents' records when they were growing up, and that what we're hearing in a lot of pop music now is the influence of parents' record collections?
Definitely. I think that's a good point. You talk to any, you read any interview with these bands, and a lot of them just have, they just know chapter and verse everything from, you know, Aretha Franklin to the, you know, early pop bands, the Everly Brothers. They know those harmonies, they know those records in a way that a lot of the audience doesn't, in a way because the audience doesn't hear it on the radio. And so unless they have access or interest in their parents' record collections, they just don't explore this music.
My guest is Fresh Air's rock critic Ken Tucker. We'll talk more about the year in music after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is our rock critic, Ken Tucker, who is also a critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. And we're talking about the year in pop music. Well, let's look at the year in hip-hop. Is there any one performer or one record that really stands out for you?
Yes, 50 Cent, or as I've been corrected by so many of your listeners, I'm supposed to say 50 Cent. doesn't that trip off my tongue smoothly? Really put out, I think, the single of the year in hip-hop, this absolutely inescapable, and who would want to escape it, called a song called In the Club. There's a whole element of hip-hop this year derived from the Deep South. There's a new genre called crunk, typified by a lot of 50 Cent's work and a group called Lil Jon and the East Side Boys. And it's kind of what we're talking about, deep influence by George Clinton's P-Funk, combined with hardcore hip-hop and rap. And it makes for a kind of much more, it's still harsh, still hard, but also the rhythms are much more kind of easy rolling a lot of the time. And the vocals are slurred in this very, very attractive way. I mean, it's very easy to get caught up in the rhythm of the song. And I think In the Club is a very good example of that.
Here's 50 Cent.
Go, 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 shawty. It's your birthday. We gon' party like it's your birthday. We gon' sip a Cardi like it's your birthday. And you know we don't give a f***. That's your birthday. You can find me in the club. Bottle full of bub. Mama, I got what you need. If you need to fill the buzz. I'm into having sex. I ain't into making love. So come give me a hug. If you're into getting rough. You can find me in the club. Bottle full of bub. Mama, I got what you need. If you need to fill the buzz. I'm into having sex. I ain't into making love. So come give me a hug. If you're into getting rough. When I pull up out front, you see the Benz.
That's 50 Cent. My guest is Ken Tucker, Fresh Air's rock critic. You want to talk about the most overrated record of the year?
Yes, it's Joss Stone's The Soul Sessions, he said with great firmness and finality. You know, last year to me, the overrated person was Norah Jones. This year it's Joss Stone. You know, I'm sure she's a very nice 16-year-old British woman who, you know, the hype was, listen to this record. You're not going to believe it's by a white British girl. She sounds just like Aretha Franklin. And it's like, well, yes, but you have to add something of yourself to that. I mean, she surrounded herself with a lot of veteran soul singers. Soul singer Betty Wright was literally her vocal coach on this album. And it just kind of breaks my heart because Betty Wright still sounds great. And it's too bad that she can't put out albums that, you know, can get as much airplay as Joss Stone did. I saw Joss Stone perform in a club. And she had three black backup singers, and I could swear that every time they approached the microphone to sing the refrain, they kind of cut their eyes at Joss, like, there but for the grace of your skin goes me. I think it's a classic example of the novelty of a white singer sounding black coming, you know, this is the history of so much popular music. But it really drove me up the wall a lot of times when I would hear this praise for Joss Stone.
So what do you think is behind her success? Do you think that she's actually tapping into something, or do you think it's just brilliant marketing?
I think she taps into a certain thirst that older listeners, baby boomers, have to hear good old-fashioned soul music, certainly. But there's also,
I mean, like, it reaffirms, like, oh, here's a 16-year-old who loves what I love.
Yes.
That's affirming.
Yes. And also just the fact that she's white is more comforting. They can relate in some way more fully to Joss Stone in a way that they can't to a new young black singer coming up.
Should we play this or should we skip it, Ken?
Let's skip it, shall we? She gets enough attention elsewhere.
Okay. Ken, we'll all feel cheated unless you give us your 10 best list, even though we're not playing excerpts from all 10 of those records. Would you just run through the list for us? And we'll also put it on our website.
Okay, great. The albums are, in this order, Willie Nelson's Crazy, The Demo Sessions, Outkast's Speaker Box, The Love Below, The White Stripes, the album called Elephant, Fountains of Wayne's Welcome Interstate Managers, Macy Gray, a terribly underrated album this year called The Trouble with Being Myself, The High Strung, These Are the Good Times, and Blue, an album called Redhead, both of those part of that pop rock trend I was talking to you about. Liz Phair's album, which she called Liz Phair, great comeback that not enough people got into. A fairly recent record that I'm just getting into and just absolutely loving, a brother and sister duo called The Fiery Furnaces. The album is called Gallows Birds Bark. And number 10, Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, Come Poop With Me, which I just think is a wonderful throwback. It's the best comedy album since, before Bob Newhart, before maybe a Red Fox album that I can't think of the title of.
That dog has a future in show business.
He really does. And rap.
Well, again, that'll be on our website, which is at freshair.com. Ken Tucker, thank you for being here. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Same to you, Terry. Thanks.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic and critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Roberta Shurek, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. All of us wish you a very merry Christmas.
No dejes cascabelito de repiquetear, en cada Navidad él vuelve a sonar. Cascabelito, cascabelero,
campanita de Navidad,
por ser tan lindo es que yo te quiero,
campanita de Navidad,
alegrando a toda mi América,
campanita de Navidad,
saludando aquí, saludando allá,
campanita de Navidad,
con un mensaje de felicidad,
campanita de Navidad,
al niño Dios viene a saludar.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Broken Music, a memoir by Sting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin our holiday series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway. We'll feature an interview with the late composer Burton Lane. His songs include How About You and Old Devil Moon. And we'll hear excerpts of two concerts with the late singer Susanna McCorkle. I'm Terry Gross. Join us on Christmas for Fresh Air.